The video moves me because I, like you, I want to come to the end of the finite number of days that I get on this earth, and I want to look back without regret. And I want to be able to assess the life that I have lived from the end, and to assess that I have lived that life, that one life that I get, that I've lived it well. I don't want to regret that I didn't spend enough time with the people that I love. I don't want to regret that I controlled too much, which would be my tendency, or that I relaxed too little. I want to have grown sufficiently so that I can transcend the coping strategies that we all create in order to survive in this dangerous world. And what I don't want is I don't want to look back and realize that I have gotten stuck in some thought pattern, in some habit pattern that dominated my life. I want to have matured to the place that I thrive in the midst of suffering, not just during the good times, but in the midst of the hard times too. I don't want to have lived my life bound up by fear. I don't want to have driven so hard for closure that I didn't let life unfold wisely or well. I want to have grown. I want to have lived virtuously, and I want to have loved well, and I'm sure that that is true for you as well. And on top of that, I want to have desired the experience of divine life. You've heard us talk about the two-step dance of the spiritual journey, desire and pay attention, desire and pay attention. I want to have desired well. And I want to have learned well. I want to have lived well. I want to have danced that two-step dance so that the deepest desires of my heart have been for the divine movement in my soul and to have borne the fruit of the Spirit of God in the days that I have lived. As we saw last week, I want to have worked the circle. I want to have given my life in sufficient measure to spiritual friendship and to the communal practices. I want to have given my life in sufficient measure to soul quietness, to the contemplative practices. I want to have been a lifelong learner as I look back from my deathbed. And I want to have served the earth. I want to have bettered the earth faithfully and steadily, honorably. And these are desires that we all share. These are things when we reflect on this one life that we have been given to live. We want to look back from our deathbeds and do so without regret. We want to look back and to assess that we have lived well. However, our tradition, and every other tradition as well, warns us clearly. We don't arrive at that peaceful, regretless deathbed without bringing focus and attention to how we live our days. Teach us to number our days that we may gain hearts of wisdom. Help us keep the end in mind. That is the prayer. Help us keep the end in mind while we are living out the middle and the beginning. Help us, the ancient prayer asks, to help us live this day with an eye to that day. It's very difficult to be embroiled in the moment, very difficult to be caught up in the exigencies and the urgencies of everyday life. It's very difficult to do that and keep an eye to the future. It is very difficult to make today's decisions with an eye to the long run. But that is where the tradition helps us, because it is so demandingly difficult to do that in the present moment. That's why we have a weekly spiritual gathering as part of the rhythm of our lives. That's why we come to church on Sundays instead of reading the paper. It's why we give ourselves to the practices of working the circle. It's why we take those ancient ways and make them part of the rhythm of our daily and our weekly lives. It's why, as I said last week, the spiritual community takes these ancient practices and puts them into an easy-to-remember, pithy mnemonic tool that says, hey, work the circle. This is a way to make sure that you end well. This is why we create spaces together in the spiritual community that you saw earlier, where we come down here and we say, these are the communal practices, these are the contemplative practices. These are the learning and serving practices, because together we can pursue that end point better than we can alone. When the community creates these spaces and then participates in these spaces together, we pull one another along to a place that we want to go, a place that, left to our own devices, often we fail to arrive. That's what spiritual community does for us. That's why we put in the hard work to create the community. That's why we all together fund it. That's why we contribute to making it happen. Because as we shape the community together, then the community returns the favor and begins to shape us. It helps us toward the deathbed in which we want to lie. It gives us a heritage that we can pass on to the generation that comes behind us, the lives we want to live. One of the things that we encourage one another toward, as we saw last week, is a regular rhythm of examining our lives. Teach us to number our days is another way of asking ourselves, am I living the life that I want to live? Am I living the life that takes me where I want to go? Am I living the life that prioritizes the things that are most important, that I most believe matter? Am I doing that? And we saw last week, in the tradition, we regularly take stock of our lives, how we're doing, where we're going. We encourage one another, as we did last week, to take regular seasons of self-examination. Last week, I suggested a framework that you can follow in the making of that inventory on a regular basis, assessing our relational lives, assessing our work lives, our personal habits, our false self-persona. There's a whole list of things there. If you missed last week, you can listen online. Well, today I want to pick up kind of where I left off last week by looking at one of the pitfalls that comes with these regular seasons of self-examination. And the pitfall is this. Often, we will confuse examination with resolution. And they're not the same. Examination is the act of seeing our lives. Resolution is setting an agenda for fixing our lives. The former is a gentle observer. The other is an often harsh upper brain taskmaster. Now, I've been doing this for quite some number of years now, and I've noticed a pattern, and that is when a minister like me stands up and gives a lesson like this, hey, it's a season for reflection on our lives. When that happens, the young people who hear a lesson like today's will often hear this encouragement to self-examination and will often mistake self-examination for self-improvement. And in making that mistake and hearing the call to self-improvement, even though it is a call to self-examination, they will respond to the challenge with eagerness and with hope and with energy. XYZ habit, they will say, I don't want to have that XYZ habit in my life. It's been plaguing me for some time now, and it's time for a change. It's time to turn over a new leaf. It's time to go a new way. Older people, on the other hand, will make the same mistake and confuse self-examination with self-improvement, but when they do, they will bring weariness to the endeavor, a weariness that is born of, man, I've been there, man, I've done that, and man, I am tired. And so their tendency is to see the youthful zeal and to look at it condescendingly. Well, honey, the old people might smile, good luck with that resolution of yours. But neither of those approaches is particularly helpful when it comes to growth on the life journey, when it comes to growth on the spiritual journey, because they both assume that change is going to unfold in our lives as a function of will, as a function of determination, as a function of effort, and as a function of good intent. The only difference between the two is that the young still think that that's an effective strategy, and the older among us are just a little bit more jaded. We both are still saddled with a very American instinct because we are Americans and we are a can-do people. We are a make-it-happen people. We are a drive-forward nation. And so, change for our souls must function like change in every other arena of our lives. It's going to happen through the force of effort. Consequently, New Year's resolutions, seasons of examination and change, tend to get dismissed in the ash bin of ineffectiveness. Today, we enter into this new month of a new year. We're fresh from the very important part of the annual rhythm in which we celebrate, maybe even overindulged a bit. And it's a time that invites us now to take a breath, to think about our lives again, and an opportunity is set before us because of the timing of the moment, a prompting, an invitation to take a look at our lives. But oftentimes we hear that invitation calling us to screw our determination to the sticking point. I am really going to do it this time. We're going to work ourselves into an effort-driven agenda for self-improvement. And if we do that, the high probability is that we will enjoy limited success, if even that. Because as we've seen in previous lessons, there's the one over there on advocating for the upper brain and the lower brain. As we've seen in previous lessons, you can sometimes get the upper brain to dictate to the lower brain and say, shape up and fly right for a little while in a limited way. But over the long haul, it just doesn't work. Dominating our lives through good planning, dominating our lives through willpower, this may have some limited effectiveness, but it is not the spiritual tradition. It is what sells weight loss programs at this time of year. You'll see a bunch of them being advertised. I think gyms probably make their annual budget this month while people are joining the gyms and getting committed. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, I'm getting back on the health and wellness bandwagon again after the holidays. It's part of the rhythm that we have to create into our lives because we live in a sedentary society now. We make our living on a chair rather than working in a field somewhere. So we do need to bring that part into our lives. But determination and effort, these are not the drivers of the spiritual tradition. They are not what we mean when we use the term examination. I want to reiterate a recurring theme that you will hear at NRCC quite a bit, and that is this. When you and I use the word me, we are talking about a very complicated idea. There is the me that struggles to hurt people in the service of a task. Ask my wife. That has happened in my life. And then there's the me that stands outside of that pattern and watches it happen. There's the me that does that habit pattern, that coping strategy, that Enneagram type 8 thing that I've done. And then there's the me that can stand outside of that and see it. So now there's two me's. And then there's a third me over here looking at the two, making a moral distinction between the two, saying, I think that one's better, I think that one's worse. I think the doing and the not doing, I think the observing and this, I think. So it's a very complicated idea when I use the term me. And what is me? What is the deepest part that defines what is self? And the spiritual tradition has tried to answer that question by distinguishing between the false self and the true self. We've used the term here in these previous lessons, the upper brain self and the lower brain self. Or we've also talked about the divine breath self or the ego as self. But our tradition teaches us that this deeper version of us, the deepest part that we can access, is silent. The deepest part that we can access is simply an observer. The me that is able to make an honest, informed, and deep observation of life, and in particular, my life, that part of me that's able to do an honest and serious, watchful examination and do it without the harshness that comes with judging ourselves and to do it without overly damning this condemnation upon ourselves or, on the other hand, an overactive sense of self-excusing or self-justifying. The spiritual tradition of self-examination is just that. It is examining. It is seeing. We investigate, We probe, we watch, we ask, and we do it with these varnished layers over the top of them. And that can kind of sound just a little bit pointless. I mean, what's the point of observing ourselves if we don't do something about it? While it seems kind of anemic to just give our focus to watching instead of doing something, that the very fact that we jumped to doing too early often is the source behind our inability to see the change we want to see, because we don't give observing its place. Self-observation, all by itself, is quite a powerful change dynamic. You've heard me say this before. You can't unsee something you've once seen. You can't unhear something you've once heard. So when Jesus says, having eyes that see and having ears that hear, that's a powerful construct for change dynamic in our lives. Seeing changes us. And so settling into that quiet, non-judging, non-doing, non-fixing, observing self, a powerful construct for change. And we come to see ourselves gently, patiently. We even bring lovingness to self-observation. We see what we do, and perhaps we gain some understanding into why we do it. We see how our lower brain is seeking some kind of balance, or how our heart is chasing after an unmet need. And we understand how our life survival strategy has kicked in and drives the things that we do, and we just see these things. We don't fix them. We just note them. We can't unsee something we've once seen. And the quiet examination of our lives and of our souls and of our motivations and of our fears, those unspoken impulses that happen inside of us all the time, maybe even the origins behind those impulses, when we grant ourselves the gentle and loving acceptance of our imperfections as well as our strengths, the dark side, the weak side of our gift, as well as the strength of the gift itself, when we grant ourselves the gift of quiet observation, we unleash something quite unexpected in our culture. We unleash change power. We unleash a powerful dynamic to bring the change and growth that we yearn for in our lives. Teach us to number our days is a prayer for sight. It's a prayer for seeing what we do and why we do it. It's a prayer for understanding our complicated interior lives. It's the prayer of the observer. It's also the prayer of the confessor. The ancient practice of confession is the practice of observation. Now, if you're sitting here and you've been to church and you've kind of heard that word before, there's a really good chance you've got a really tweaked idea of what the word confession means. Here's what it usually means. It means you better fess up and say the bad thing you've done because we caught you. Or it means you better not think more highly of yourself than you ought to think because you're really a sinner. And damn it, we want to make sure you know you're a sinner, and so we better hear your sin. Come on, fess up. And you can do it in an accountability group, or you can do it in a box if you come from a liturgical tradition. You do it, but in so doing, we miss the whole point of what confession is about. It's not about any of that. God is singularly disinterested. If God were humanoid like we, that humanoid form would be singularly disinterested in trying to make sure that we know our place in the universe. That's just not the way it works. What confession is about, it's about setting aside time and energy to see ourselves. It's about setting aside time and energy to observe ourselves, to watch ourselves, to be the deep, quiet observer, truer self. And there's something powerful about that dynamic, because by settling into simply watching, without judgment, without criticism, without a self-improvement agenda, just to watch, we settle into something that turns out to be quite powerful. We settle into the art of seeing. We practice being our truest version of self, the silent observer self. Now, that will change us. That will teach us to number our days. That will grant us a heart of wisdom. That will take us to the deathbed on which you and I want to lie. Now, we Americans, we have been steeped in a version of power that is very overt. The power that we know about is not subtle at all. It's the power of conquest. It's the power of subjugating. It's the power of invading. It's the power of routing. It's the power of overthrowing. We have a problem, we go right after it. We conquer it. We invade it. We destroy it. We root it out. And that really works in one arena. If you are the inheritor of the legacy of empire, which we all are, if you have been steeped in the values of Rome, whose purpose was to conquer the known world, and if your religion was joined in 1700 years ago with the Roman ethic and took on the norms and the practices of imperial power, then those instincts about power make a tremendous amount of sense. If you're going out trying to conquer territory, that's a great way to think about power. But they are not the power instincts that drive Jesus' teaching on the kingdom of God. He says there's a different kind of empire. There's a different kind of structure. There's a different kind of way by which people organize themselves together. And the power that works in that kingdom is much more subtle. The power that works effectively in that kingdom is much more indirect. It's not about overt defeat. It's about subtle growth. Consider how powerful a forest is, populated by trees. All that happened to make this powerful, expansive growth of life come into being was seed and soil and sun and water and weight. There was no conquesting going on. There was no rooting out or overpowering going on. And yet this powerful reality has come into being. That's a much better metaphor for the power that works in this new kind of kingdom that Jesus taught us. It's the power of meekness, Jesus said, the power of gentleness, Jesus said, the power of kindness and the power of graciousness. It's an indirect way to power. It's a subtle way to power. If we allow ourselves to get unbusy enough to see a problem, if we can step back far enough to experience being that second version of me, the one who can watch me do the things that I do, if we can become the observer, and if we can bring gentleness to our observing, if we can bring honesty and kindness to our observing, if we get that far and we don't get distracted by the bread and circuses that comprises so much of our economy, if we can get that far, once we see the problem that happens in this lesser version of me, our tendency is to go to the only power source that we know about. We go to dominance power. Dominate the weakness. Overcome the weakness. Resolve to do better. Rout the resistance by appealing to willpower. Defeat the enemy by force of superior effort. And gentleness and love and truth and graciousness, these just don't seem to be power sources at all. No more than does sun and soil and seed and water. Having eyes to see and having ears to hear, being an observer, that doesn't seem powerful. When are you going to do something? Meekness inheriting the earth, knowing the truth and then being set free, these don't seem like power sources. Our instincts don't allow those to make it through the filter. The idea that these would be power sources just doesn't make any sense to us because we've got Roman imperial eyes on. Power is dominating. Power is not being gentle. Power is routing the enemy. It's not silently observing the self. And so we come to seasons in which our tradition invites us to examination invites us to observation, but we've been trained to think in terms of self-improvement. We've been trained to marshal the forces of dominance power and to do it, to dominate our weaknesses and to dominate our shortcomings. So, of course, the older among us have become jaded. Of course, the more seasoned among us have wearied from repetitive failure, because willpower is a very limited power source when it comes to the human being. Dominance is a very imperfect, a very inadequate power source. It's the sun and soil kinds of things that are powerful. Love, it turns out, is power. Grace toward ourselves and toward others, it turns out, is powerful. It is transformative. Seeing the truth sets us free. Gentleness toward what we see when we examine ourselves. And let's be honest, sometimes it's kind of dark. Gentleness, it turns out, is power. Who knew? Americans didn't know, but the ancients knew. Those who have gone before us on the spiritual journey, they knew. And they wrote to us, and they told us. They taught us a way of practicing being the observer self. They taught us a way that is greater. They taught us a way that is more powerful than discipline and drive. They taught us a way that is more powerful than grit and determination. They taught us a way that is more powerful than force and resolution. It is a simple way. It is a gentle way. We're honest with ourselves, but we're gentle with ourselves. We're frank and we're candid with ourselves, but we're also kind and tender toward ourselves. We don't strain to dominate our weaknesses. We begin with the simple, gentle, non-judgmental practice of observing. When we speak about working the circle, and we talk about the contemplative quadrant over here, we talk about meditation, we talk about examine of consciousness, we talk about the practice of confession, the practice of self-awareness and self-disclosure, all the things of quietly this observing self, that's a big part of what we're talking about in that whole quadrant. We quiet ourselves and we simply observe. When we invite one another to these ancient contemplative practices, in essence, we're inviting one another to be taught how to number our days that we may gain hearts of wisdom. Because unbeknownst to most of us living in our culture, we are being invited into another profound basis of power, change dynamic power, transformed soul kind of power, seeing what we hadn't seen, eyes that see and ears that hear power. Again, who knew? And again, did I mention Wednesday evenings are going to be about contemplative? So, Spirit of God, may our ways be the ways of regular examination. And may our ways be ways of inner observing, quiet seeing. May our ways be gentle and kind. May our ways ring a bell that cannot be unrung. See and hear what cannot be unseen, unheard. May we experience the transformative work that our tradition says is part of walking this path. May that be our experience as well. In Jesus' name, amen.